Welcome to Zero Point Teaching. Another Saturday afternoon with Dr. Christopher Holmes, which is myself, and online in the background we have James Moffat. Jim, do you want to share your voice?
Yes, I'm here. Hi.
Hi, Jim. Welcome back.
Thank you.
Okay, so I'd like to open up by just making a few notes. Firstly, I was just looking at the BBS website, and I noticed that there are three major shows of mine posted there in the archives now. One is on what is consciousness, the second is on the law of three and seven, and the third is on zero-point dynamics. And just very, very pleased. I'd like to thank Donald and Doug Newsome for their work in getting those shows up and available to the public. They're available online to anyone in the world. That's quite remarkable. And I'd like to express my appreciation to them and realizing what a wonderful job they're doing here at BBS Radio with a wide breadth of programming and information and that they're providing. Oh, my computer my screensaver here. But anyway, so do have a look at the shows. They're archived. They're usually available 2 to 3 weeks after shows. So I firstly want just to direct your attention to that. Secondly, I invite people, listeners, to view my website at www.zeropoint.ca, and I have selections from all of my books available on my site, although some of them are older editions slightly of my writings. I've recently revised my two primary books called The Heart Doctrine and Microcosm Macrocosm, and I'm very, very pleased with the new editions of these books, and I hope to post some chapters from the new editions over the next week. But do have a look at my site. And the whole framework of understanding that I'm trying to explain through this radio show is a profoundly alternative model of the nature of reality and of self, what we are in the mystical dimensions of ourself. And it takes considerable time to kind of understand and appreciate all that this framework of ideas entails. It's not that it could, I mean, even myself, I've struggled towards understanding these teachings and this type of teaching over 30-year time period now. And the aim of, in understanding the ideas, is not simply to grasp them with our mind and intellectually and be able to remember them, but further to go beyond the words to what is being pointed to in terms of experiencing that within yourself and the meaning of what I'm trying to point to. For instance, I talk about the heart doctrine and I explain how in all the mystical and spiritual psychologies, the heart is regarded as the primary center of I or of self, and the awakening of self within the heart, and God is within the heart, or the monad, or the jiva atma, or the indestructible God for the Dalai Lama, the bliss sheath for the yogi. These are the Nandamaya Kosha, it's called, the bliss sheath. These are within the heart. Okay, so we can have this idea. Oh, yeah, he says consciousness originates from the heart. So we can have that as an idea, and that's a beginning, and that's valuable for us to firstly acquire the idea. But the idea is also pointing beyond itself to the experience of the self within the heart, and that's what we're trying to get to. So having the idea alone is not sufficient. We need to have the ideas and then have the experiences of this, and then that develops understanding in us. And that's not something that can be done in an afternoon or in an hour or 2 hours. These are lifelong mysteries that need to be explored as we go through life, this life and lives to come. The mysteries of the heart are profoundly deep, And people can think, oh, yeah, I understand the idea of the self connected to the heart or consciousness connected to the heart. But it's something that you can understand in a multi-dimensional way and then be experiencing it and what it really means. So I am trying to present a radically alternative model of the nature of creation and of the origins of human consciousness. If you hear a noisy sound in the background, that's one of my local neighbors has a rather powerful boat, and very noisy boat on the river here. I'm looking out over the Rideau River south of Ottawa. That's where Zero Point Radio comes from, to you from. And Jim here online is in Toronto. So we're two Canadian lads who've explored the mysteries for 30 years, and the show's trying to present areas of, summarize different areas of explorations. Okay, so just to get back. Okay, so what was it? So the idea of that I've been developing, I like to summarize some of what I've been saying in previous shows as I begin the next. And so I've just mentioned the heart doctrine, the idea of the origin of the human consciousness from the heart. So if this is true, we in our lives, we want to somehow feel a lot enlivened and awakened more and more within the heart. So what we do actually in our day and in our lives, as we go about our lives, every so often you try to wake up, to come back to yourself and tap yourself over the heart and try to feel yourself in the heart area. Try to feel your center of I within the heart. And then the way we can develop, cultivate that being present within the heart space. So we want to bring our consciousness from our mind and more experience selfness originating from within the heart and ourselves as established there. Now, in these shows, I'm actually trying to explain how there is an actual physics and higher dimensional metaphysics to what the human heart really is. I'm saying that human beings, in a way, we are not at all what we imagine ourselves to be or what contemporary scientists consider us to be. By this, what I'm saying is that in modern science, the philosophy is generally materialistic. So a human being is regarded as having a material body and a mind, but is not regarded as having a spiritual or soul nature. So we think that human consciousness is produced by the brain or by material processes. So in a way, in science, consciousness comes from below. Matter develops somehow and then produces consciousness. Well, in mystical teachings, in a sense, consciousness comes from above. Consciousness has a higher dimensional physics to it, and consciousness inhabits the material body. So there's an self or I that comes into the body, but eventually at death withdraws from the body. And even after this death, there's continued consciousness within different dimensions than within other bodies. So, in this view, in a sense, consciousness comes from above. It's not produced by the combination of material matter, but rather it has a higher dimensional physics to it. And then this originates out of the heart. So far, I've talked of the heart. I've begun to introduce the idea of the heart as a vacated space. And this we were taught in Kabbalah, that in a way, the infinite being had to vacate an empty space in order for a finite being to come into existence. Otherwise, everything is swallowed up in the infinite. So at the heart of a human being, within the heart, is a vacated space. So this is an idea in a way we can experience this idea, in a way you can feel the emptiness within your heart. And in a way we want to cultivate awareness of that and cultivate awareness of emptiness. The Dalai Lama explains the basic idea of esoteric Buddhism is the essential emptiness of everything. Well, at the heart of being, there is this emptiness or nothingness at the heart of being. This in Kabbalah is called the Zimzum contraction. So that's another idea suggesting then that there's actually a physics to this. Like if there's this empty space within the heart, this empty space exists down at Planckian levels, at lower levels of what space is. So to understand these concepts, it's going to take us into understanding other ideas in physics and science to understand what this could mean, that there would be a vacated space within the heart. To understand consciousness, in a way, I explain it as a conjunction of two elements. Aleister Crowley calls it hadith within nui. Hadith is the point source. It is the star nature, the quanta nature, like a point particle or a point source, a divine spark within the human being. So a point of light, and that is called hadith. And that point exists within Nui, which for Crowley, Nui means night in French. And so Nui is the mother space. Nui is the mother space. The mother herself is regarded as space. So Hadith within Nui is the conjunction of the spiritual element within the vacated space of Nui. And this Nui is what later I'll explain is a hyperspace, and I'm going to try to explain that. So in a way, the nature of human consciousness can be depicted as a point within a black sphere or circle, a point within space, hadith within Nui. And so also I'm saying that a human being has this point source, the jiva atma or monad, established in the higher dimensional physics of the heart. And the heart isn't simply the material heart as we think of it, but there's actually a deep physics and metaphysics between the material heart and the underlying zero-point fields that underlined and sustained creation. To understand the nature of self, we have to understand the nature of space. In a way, consciousness is like light in within space. Light is the hadith, the point source of supernal light, and it is within Nui, which is the space. So light within space. Consciousness is like light. It illuminates things, allowing us to be aware of all the different things that we can be aware of in our life. But the consciousness and the light is something separate from the material processes of which you are conscious. So you might be conscious in your material body, but when your material body dies, you're no longer conscious in your material body, but you can still be conscious within the subtle bodies. So I'm suggesting there's an actual higher dimensional physics and metaphysics to the nature of the human heart. And that is the basic idea of the zero-point doctrine, is that there is a zero-point center within the human being. And we're struggling to try to understand what that would mean and the implications of it. In a way, everything in your life is like it is spun around a central vacated space. Everything is spun around that, but it's the presence of the no-thingness that allows you to be conscious of the thingness. So, in a way, a human being in our consciousness, we're kind of this nothingness. Okay. Sartre, the existentialist philosopher, used to describe consciousness as the nothingness at the heart of being. So that's one aspect of consciousness. Okay, so we're exploring these zero-point concepts, and the term zero-point is taken from this quotation from Madame Blavatsky from The Secret Doctrine. The Secret Doctrine is going to be the focus of the first half of this show today. So I'll just read this quote. Material points without extension, zero points, are the materials out of which the gods and other invisible powers clothe themselves in bodies. Okay, so what this is suggesting, you have a material point without extension. It's like a zero point. It's so small that it's non-perceptible. And that, through that, somehow emerging around that, that point is closed in different bodies. So you might imagine, draw on a piece of paper, a point on a piece of paper, and then draw some shells around it, in the circles around it. You might draw seven of those shells, because we'll see the hyperspace or the eternal parent space is sevenfold. So you could put a point in the circle and then have seven circles around it. In a way, that could represent like a monad in seven-dimensional hyperspace. I'm saying that we have this hidden inner structure to our consciousness, how we ourselves arise out of these underlying zero-point fields. You see, in modern science, scientists and psychologists do not really consider that a human being has any real I. And by I, I mean to spell it simply the letter I, a capital I. We don't think there is an I, a central I. Okay. Psychologists think that the sense of self derives from activity in certain parts of the frontal cortex, and they think that's where your sense of self derives, up in your mind, in your head. Whereas in mystical teachings, it's saying really there's this deep center within the heart. And, yeah. Okay, I'm lost myself a little bit here. Jim, how are you doing here? Are you
I'm listening.
Following along? I'm lost a little bit what I was trying to say. About the sense of self and how in science they don't think a human being has a central I. Like human beings, we always say I this, I that. Like, I am Chris Holmes. But I is not Chris Holmes. That's just the name that's kind of attached. I might say I'm a writer, so I attach my I to writing, but I is not my writing. I might be hungry. I say I'm hungry, or I'm sad, or I'm angry, or I'm all these different. We always say I. But whatever we say I to, in a way, is not what I is. But somehow it's like we sense that there is some central I. And I'm indeed saying that there is such a central I, and that central I, in a way, it is not this, it is not that, it is not the other. It is like not anything. Its essential nature of the I is like this nothingness at the heart of being. And our bodies are spun around that, and through this mechanism, we are brought down into the material body out of higher dimensions. Now, these higher dimensions are not simply above us, but instead, really, the way it works is from within without. What manifests without, it emerges from within. So creation is from within without. And eventually, when something dissipates or withdraws, it withdraws without within, back to a zero-point center. These are some of the teachings. Oh, and the last area that we've been exploring so far is discussion of the laws of 3 and 7. Now, what I've been trying to explain is that ordinary scientific thought and academic philosophy and common thinking tends always to be dualistically and to regard everything as dual. The mind and the body. Psychology is defined as the science of behavior and the mind. The body and the mind. Okay, and in physics we have matter and energy, and within time and space, with observers and observed. So many opposite forces. In psychology, the craze for 20 years has been left brain consciousness, right brain consciousness, or either the head and the heart. So we often construe things dualistically. And then what I've learned through my 30 years of esoteric studies is we can consider the law of three and the laws of seven as the primary numerical patterns suggested within mystical teachings. By mystical teachings, I would include Madame Blavatsky's secret doctrine, the study of Judaism and Kabbalah, the Gurdjieff Uspensky teaching, Vedic teachings, and other sources. Okay, I'd say in these spiritual sciences, these principles of the laws of three and seven are said to be fundamental cosmic laws. So when we want to understand any phenomena in life or science, instead of thinking dualistically, we try to understand things in terms of this pattern of 1, 3, 7. That something is first 1, then 3, and then manifests as 7. The analogy I've used is white light divided by a prism that gives a spectrum of 7 colors. So this, the 1 is divided by 3 and yields 7. And I'm saying this pattern of 1, 3, 7 is manifested in different phenomena of nature and science. So we want to try to understand these laws of 3 and 7, which become very complex when you really try to apply it and understand these ideas in relationship to science. So we're making the effort to consider seriously the idea of these laws of 3 and 7. Okay, so this is a summary of what we have been discussing over the last weeks. And the final thing we've been talking about, and Jim was involved with this, we've been talking about what we've called the problem of God's contracting universe. And this was based on the critique of Carl Sagan, who represents materialist science. And Sagan makes the statement that as science has advanced, there's been less and less for God to do, that we don't need to have supernatural or metaphysical ideas anymore because science is providing the answers to life. But what we've been trying to pose, though, is we try to show how superficially Sagan dismisses what religions actually say or teach, that people take only the outer form of religions, which differ from each other and are very contrary to one another. But I'm saying that there is another deeper dimension to the esoteric side of religion where they're essentially the same. Okay, and I would say that all the religions share the teaching of the heart doctrine, that human consciousness originates from the heart, and that contrasts with the modern so-called scientific viewpoint that the brain in the head produces consciousness. So I'm saying there's actually, partly the argument with Carl Sagan is saying he doesn't really know what esoteric teachings teach. And we have to consider esoteric teachings and look at them as providing scientific ideas and hypotheses and theories. And that's what I'm making an effort to do, is to draw us to carry out some comparative analysis of modern science and mystical teachings. And so today, the first part of the show, this has been an introduction. The first part of the show, I'm beginning to explain some of Blavatsky's secret doctrine, And the second part of the show, then Jim and I will kind of discuss some of that material and relate it to this issue of what I've called the problem of God's contracting universe. Okay, how are we doing? Jim, are you there? Any comments, anything you'd like to share?
Yeah, no, I'm following along. It's a lot of material to digest. I think you've covered the basic points that we've talked about in the last few weeks and that you presented in your earlier presentations. And I think one thing is just that in the esoteric, when you were talking about the problem of God's contracting universe and Carl Sagan's perspective, and he represents materialist modern science, which searches for natural laws and physical explanations of things, and whereas in the esoteric tradition, mystical tradition, at the center of that tradition is the idea that consciousness can be transformed, and that leads to an entirely different understanding of both the nature of what human beings are and what they can become, and in the nature of reality. So really this whole model of consciousness which you're developing, derived from esoteric teachings, is both profound and much more sophisticated, I think, than anything that exists in modern science's treatment of consciousness, which tends to be actually very superficial. And I think that's one of the points that you make in your comparative analysis. Sagan and materialists tend to say, well, they tend to treat mysticism, first of all, as a catch-all category for that which is unprovable and unsubstantiated and vague and misty. And what you're pointing out is that really these are very profound ideas that require complex concerted effort to understand. Because you could spend 30 years and really only begin to grasp what they're talking about. And really, to really consider these ideas is in itself most revealing, because you see that there are many myths surrounding mysticism and esotericism in terms of modern thinking, and that really there's a very provocative and deeply moving and inspiring explanation of the nature of self and the nature of consciousness and the nature of the universe and the nature of human being and purpose.
Yeah, alternate to what is provided in modern science and philosophy and education. Yeah,
and at the same time, as you've shown in your work, really many of the ideas are quite compatible and even illuminate scientific ideas, say, in modern physics. They provide a sort of something that's missing in modern physics and kind of go beyond modern physics. And yet, at the same time, they don't contradict the facts of science in any way at all. In fact, they're quite congruent with them.
Yeah, that's most important. It's a new way of reinterpreting the facts of science. That's what it provides if you have a mystical perspective. As an example, like I've talked previously about the law of 1, 3, and 7 and how you can apply that to understanding the nature of the periodic tables. Okay, the nature of the periodic tables depict all the elements that compose the material world. And they're all composed of three elements, protons, electrons, and neutrons, which are your law of three. And then you have seven rows of elements in the periodic tables. And even if you go into the rows of elements, you see other octave patterns. So that the fact that the scientists can discern all the elements of nature doesn't disprove mystical teachings. In fact, it kind of provides support for that model of the threefold and sevenfoldness.
Yeah, which is what you'd expect if there's validity to these ideas.
And I guess to bring back to
something that you said and that I was actually trying to get to was just speaking of the mystical and esoteric tradition and the model of consciousness that exists there. If you work hard enough to mine it, it needs to be refined and needs to be understood through concerted effort. But really, within modern science and modern thought, I think it's generally recognized and conceded by people who have looked at consciousness that this is really the great unanswered question which exists within modern thought and modern science. What is the nature of consciousness? And that if we really understood this, that many of the mysteries that confront as many of the enigmas and paradoxes that confront modern science, many of the limits that modern science has come up against, would be resolved. And the ironic situation is that these ideas have existed for thousands of years, and yet modern scientists and thinkers in general tend to be completely unaware of and actually profoundly ignorant of these ideas.
Yeah, as science has become more and more specialized and technical, we've gotten away from the fundamental principles.
Exactly.
Oh, I have just received a nice email here from Reverend Juliet Nightingale, and just saying how much she's appreciated listening to Zero Point program on BBS Radio. And Juliet herself has a show called Towards the Light, and herself has had experiences of near death and such, and been on the other side, and realized that she's still been conscious and alive. So she says, and I can attest from experience that this is indeed true, that we are these multidimensional beings and exist beyond the body. It's amazing, really, that this is the idea that is the most important and profound idea that leads us to question everything we think we know about what consciousness is in modern science. Like, this is what led me to having out-of-body experiences and other paranormal experiences, led me to realize that consciousness couldn't simply be produced by the body and the mind. So we need another kind of model of how this could work. When we leave the body, or we, after death, in other dimensions, what is the science of these dimensions? Like, where are these worlds? Where are the soul worlds or the heaven worlds? And where do we go to after death? And what is the science of it, the physics and the metaphysics? So if we begin to realize that I am not the body, that consciousness isn't simply produced by the brain in the head, and we begin to realize all the overwhelming evidence for paranormal faculties and experiences, then we arrive that we have to develop a new model of the nature of reality. It needs to be a multidimensional model, that we can indeed, we are clothed in different bodies, and that somehow we come out of higher dimensional space, and that there is some type of permanent I or self nature which transcends the material world. So that's what, in the way I'm doing with the Zero Point teaching, is trying to look at, to develop the model and understanding of how such things could actually operate. What are the physics and metaphysics of this multidimensional universe? So thank you, Juliet, and I'll explore your site and listen to your show. And Juliet also expresses the effort that Don and Doug are doing in making these services and this programming, alternative programming, available to people.
Well, that's very interesting that her email that she refers to her experiences, because I think that when you begin to talk to people, and when you go out and lecture and have discussions with people, it's amazing how many people you speak to who can present an experience or several experiences in which they experience themselves, quote unquote, their sense of I, quote unquote, as being somehow separate from their physical material body. And I'm always stunned by how often when I start talking about this with people, that people come up with an explanation of something that to them is inexplicable, and which in terms of modern scientific thinking is totally inexplicable. And as you said before, way back when you began to be interested in esoteric teachings, in part it came from your explanation of paranormal phenomena, where you realized that there were so many accounts of these paranormal experiences that you began to take, rather than trying to prove whether or not they exist, you began to try to understand, well, you know, I'll assume that they exist because there's just so many of them. How is this possible? which led you to a different conceptualization of consciousness, and which really shows, again, as I said before, how superficial the scientific explanation of consciousness is. So the modern scientific explanation of consciousness is really, when you look at it, not an explanation at all. It's an attempt to account. It's an attempt to fit something into a model in which it just does not fit.
Yeah. Stanislav Grof says the same thing. He says it is completely an assumption. He calls it the fundamental assumption underlying modern psychology is that the brain or the mind produces consciousness. But it's simply an assumption, and then people have closed their eyes to all those evidences which suggest that there's something else. There has to be something much deeper and more profound.
Yeah, and I think I believe it's in Cosmos that Carl Sagan says that, he says point blank that the cerebral cortex is where consciousness is produced in the brain, something to that effect. And yet, realistically, there's no scientific evidence that nobody's ever observed that, for instance. I mean, there's no scientific evidence that the cerebral cortex produces consciousness. There's all sorts of evidence that the cerebral cortex is somehow associated with consciousness in some limited aspect, but that's all there is.
Yes, yeah, and they jump from that assumption to that general proposition. I know in my writing I like using that cover article from Scientific American 2005, and the article, what is the enigmas, what's the title of that article? The Enigmas of Consciousness, and what it shows is a brain lit up inside with something like lightning bolts coming down into the brain. And it's just assumed that the brain produces consciousness, and you see how many books on human consciousness, they all show a picture of a head. It's like a head cut off from a body. No one has a book on consciousness where they focus on the heart as the center of consciousness. That's why I once said, all you got to do is stick a brain on the cover of your book and you can call it science.
Yeah, you know, I think we should just point out that you're not saying that in your work that the brain is not involved in consciousness, or that the brain that the heart is the sole source of, well, actually, I think you are saying it's the origin of consciousness, but it's much more complex than that. That there's an interaction between the heart, the brain, and the rest of the body. I mean, that consciousness isn't just restricted to the heart.
No, because I'm connecting the experience of consciousness into the body with the circulation of blood. So it's actually the dynamics of the heart and the circulation of blood. That's why, and I believe there's consciousness in the mind, in the head. I'm just saying the mind doesn't produce the consciousness.
Yeah,
instead,
exactly.
The consciousness can illuminate the mind, allow us to be aware of mental processes. So whenever you use a part of your cortex, because you do an arithmetic problem, the blood flows to your parietal lobe, because that's involved in that mental faculty. So you're conscious up in that part of your brain. That's kind of, you're partly conscious there. So your consciousness can be throughout the whole body. And including the mind. And it's so interesting how mystics compare the heart, the self within the heart is compared to the sun, described as inherently self-illuminating. And the mind in the head is compared to the moon, because the moon has no light of its own, it only reflects the light of the sun. So similarly, mystics say the mind in the head, it doesn't have its own light, it only reflects the light of the self which emerges from the heart, and that illuminates the mind. And if we can be awakened, then it illuminates higher faculties of the mind. So even if we look at the system of chakras, we see, you have your throat chakra, it's below your head, and then your brow chakra and your saraswa, your crown chakra. So you have two centers for conscious experiencing and awakening within the levels of the mind in the subtler bodies. So in this model, consciousness can pervade the body and the subtle bodies, and there's a whole inner physics and dynamics of how the inner circulation of light is like the essential structure of the inner man or inner being is, again, it's like the 1, the 3, and the 7. So in the indestructible drop within the heart, from there, the three channels go out and distribute the light through a system of 7 chakras. So the idea of this inner circulation of light. So consciousness is within can be within the heart, but also illuminates the mind. And then consciousness exists even when the body's lying vacant on the floor in a medical emergency or near-death experience. A person is still conscious. And even when they're out of their body, they can still think and feel and have personal identity and have memory of their personal history. So that suggests that all of these normal experiences aren't simply produced by the physical body. That's only a mechanism for these. But we can feel even out of the body because we have an astral body and our emotions are within the astral body and within its structures. Okay.
I think that metaphor of the sun and the moon is really, really, it's so simple, but in a way it's so profound too, because it really does, it provides a lovely illustration of what, you know, of how radically different this conceptualization of consciousness really is. I guess you were going to get into Madame Blavatsky and the sacred doctrine.
Yeah, I will come back to that. And,
yeah.
And are you going to stay online there,
yep.
Jim, in the background? And,
yep. Oh,
yeah, that's good. So I'm pleased with this kind of summary, try to, you know, again, remind the listener the themes. We're talking about the heart doctrine. We're talking about the concept of zero point. We're trying to understand the new model of creation, of higher dimensional reality, of how we actually come down or from within without out of higher dimensional space. So I would claim human beings, we ourselves are extraterrestrials. People think, have you ever seen an extraterrestrial? Well, we ourselves are extraterrestrial. I say we have these higher dimensional physical and metaphysical origins. I would say the origin of ourself is even mysteriously interconnected to the nature of the sun, and that we could live in the sun as part of our multidimensional life. Okay, so as Jim said, the focus on today was going to be on the secret doctrine of Madame Blavatsky. So I'd like to just begin. I'll give some background to the secret doctrine. It was published in 1888. The subtitle is The Synthesis of Science, Religion, and Philosophy. The Secret Doctrine is a classic and authoritative work that's had a broad influence on the last century of Western occultism. Blavatsky's teaching is known as Theosophy. Theo meaning God and Sophy meaning wisdom. So Theosophy implies the idea of divine wisdom. So the secret doctrine, Blavatsky explains, is not simply her writing, but she's trying to synthesize different esoteric mystical teachings. The secret doctrine is a massive, almost incomprehensible document. It's one of those books that you can study over years and try to grasp it more and more. It's composed of two volumes. The first is called Cosmogenesis, and this, as the title implies, deals with the genesis of the cosmos, or in modern language, the creation of the universe. The second book deals with anthropogenesis, meaning the genesis of the anthropedes, or I guess anthropods, or human beings. Anthropogenesis deals with the evolution of human beings and mankind through different cycles of life and creation. Now, my talk and my specialty is primarily in book one of The Secret Doctrine on cosmogenesis. And today what I'm going to do is compare the cosmology and physics or metaphysics of Blavatsky's Secret Doctrine to other ideas in modern science. Now, recall that Blavatsky was writing in 1888, and in her book, he tried to address the issues of science. Blavatsky was very interested in science and always said that we needed to lay scientific and mystical axioms side by side to draw comparisons. She said the main thing with modern science is that they ignored consideration of the metaphysical nature of life. At one point she says, all physics carried far enough leads to metaphysics. And I would say any science carried far enough leads to metaphysics. Blavatsky says, because these things exist, as I would agree. So physics must yield to metaphysics. Okay, Blavatsky was born in Russia in 1831 and died in 1891. She was a remarkable, extraordinary woman who traveled widely and very independent through her life and living in Russia and America and Europe and India, and founded the Theosophical Society, wrote a large, massive volume of work. Main books, The Secret Doctrine, Isis Unveiled, The Key to Theosophy, and other pieces. I've always admired Madame Blavatsky. She's one of my heroes, if I can have a hero. And I always love this quotation. This was from an English gentleman, Steed, who once was... He was a very well-known editor of an English newspaper, and when The Secret Doctrine was published, he wrote to Madame Blavatsky, and he said, "You are a very great woman, and I do not think that anybody but yourself, either man or a woman, could have written The Secret Doctrine. Nor do I feel competent from the depths of my ignorance even to express an opinion upon its extraordinary contents. I do not profess to understand you, for you inhabit space of more dimensions than I can even conceive. But I am not so great a fool as to be unable to see that you have a genius quite transcendent." I think that's an absolutely beautiful eulogy to Madame Blavatsky. So that's what I'm going to try to do. Let's take this, what Manly Call calls, the magnus opus of the literature of the modern world. Manly Hall, occult scholar, says that about The Secret Doctrine. That's the magnus opus of the literature of the modern world. In The Secret Doctrine, in the preface, Blavatsky says there's three objectives or aims she has in the book. The first aim was to, quote, show that nature is not a fortuitous concurrence of atoms, and to assign man his rightful place in the scheme of the universe. Blavatsky was very opposed to the mechanistic and materialist science philosophy dominant in her age, which regards the origin of the universe and mankind as simply due to the blind working out of natural laws governing material nature. Okay, this is why she says nature is not a fortuitous concurrence of atoms. It's not this simple randomness chance factor. It's so inherent to nature that instead there's design built into all phenomena, all natural phenomena. Okay, secondly, she says the aim of The Secret Doctrine is to rescue from degradation the archaic truths which are the basis for all religions, and to uncover to some extent the fundamental unity from which they all spring. So Blavatsky's, the secret doctrine is not simply Blavatsky's theories and speculations. It's her attempt to get at the essence of the perennial wisdom teachings and to try to synthesize these and present them. And she draws from such a wide variety of both Eastern and Western mystical sources throughout all her writings. She is almost unbelievable breadth of knowledge and reading demonstrated in Blavatsky's scholarship. Okay, Blavatsky says, the basic ideas of the secret doctrine are the essence of Hindu, Zoroastrian, Chaldean, Egyptian, Buddhist, Islamic, Judaic, and Christian belief, all which have emerged from one parent document. She writes, the secret wisdom was once the fountainhead, the ever-flowing perennial source at which were fed all its streamlets, the religions of all nature, the religions of all nations, from the first down to the last. So that's the secret doctrine, is trying to bring together these ancient esoteric teachings about creation processes. The third aim of the secret doctrine was to demonstrate that, quote, the occult side of nature has never been approached by the science of modern civilization. Now, Blavatsky wrote this in 1888, and I would say the mainstream of modern science still has neglected completely an attempt to study the occult side of nature. The hidden, occult means hidden, so the hidden side of nature, the spiritual and soul forces, other forces and intelligences that are manifest within the material realm. Science has made no effort to approach. Of course, you find all kinds of scientists on the borders of their discipline throughout the world and in disciplines who are making such efforts in modern times. And this is a new, very important, it's like the re-enchantment of nature. I think one author used that phrase. It's like science has denied nature any soul for 100 years, any soul or spirit or divine nature to creation. Science has denied this for a century and longer at this point. Of course, Blavatsky also said in The Secret Doctrine, she said, in our day, scientists are more self-opinionated and bigoted than even the clergy. So in Blavatsky's day, I guess we have two people opposed to occult teachings in a way, both on the scientist side who dismiss the occult and mystical or psychical and spiritual, and then on the other side, the clergy and people who have established religious dogmas and even fail to understand the esoteric side of their own religion. Blavatsky wrote in 1888, there can be no possible conflict between the teachings of occult and so-called exact science when the conclusions of the latter are grounded on the substratum of unassailable fact. Science can, it is true, collect, classify, and generalize upon phenomena, but the occultist, arguing from admittedly metaphysical data, declares that the daring explorer who would probe the innermost secrets of nature must transcend the narrow limitations of sense and transfer his consciousness into the region of no noumena and the sphere of primal causes. So here we see the primary role ascribed to Blavatsky to the transformation of consciousness as a way, as a necessary aspect of appreciating these metaphysical teachings. She also wrote, the secret doctrine must be contrasted with the speculations of modern science. Archaic axioms must be placed side by side with modern hypotheses and comparisons left to the sagacious reader. She also says, to make of science an integral whole necessitates indeed the study of spiritual and psychic as well as physical nature. Without metaphysics, real science is inadmissible. This is a beautiful quotation. See, it's what I was saying before. All physics ultimately has to lead to metaphysics. Lastly, as a way of introduction to Blavatsky's secret doctrine, she wrote, the rejection of these teachings may be expected and must be anticipated beforehand. No one styling himself a scholar in whatever department of exact science will be permitted to regard these teachings seriously. They will be derided and rejected a priori in this century, but only in this one. For in the 20th century of our era, scholars will begin to realize that the secret doctrine has neither been invented or exaggerated, but on the contrary, simply outlined. So in that, what Blavatsky's saying is in a century later, or in the coming era, people will realize the profound nature of the secret doctrine. And that is what we'll be trying to point out today, is just how profound are the relationships between Blavatsky's secret doctrine and modern scientific ideas. And these are very complex subjects. And so now I'll begin to turn my attention to some of this comparative analysis. Okay, before I go on, Jim, are you following any comments you'd like to add before I move into the actual comparative analysis?
No, I think you've introduced it rather well, and it's interesting because in a way, as you say, I guess that it'd be interesting to see what Madame Blavatsky's reaction would be today, because I would say that in a way that the situation really hasn't changed much in 125 years, that I think scientists are still rather resistant to ideas about the metaphysical nature of existence. And yet, if you take the history of 20th century physics, it really does, as she says, leads to confirmation of the secret doctrine, as you're going to explain. Or at least there's a rather striking and intriguing parallels between what she talks about and what physics has discovered and physicists have discovered and formulated in the last 100 years.
Exactly. Yeah, it's not that scientists have changed their philosophy. They still deny the occult side of nature, even in the theories I'll be looking at today, like when I talk about superstring theory or M theory or holographic theory in physics. These model of physics, none of the physicists who espouse them have an occult view of the significance of their ideas. They're just elaborating these ideas within a department, very specialized department of sub-quantum physics. But they don't think those ideas have application to understanding oneself or the nature of life, what that means for us as living beings. It's like it's a completely other, you know, it's like we have all these compartmentalized areas of knowledge, and the modern physicists and their specialty don't see the occult side of their own enigmas and theories.
Yeah, and I think a big part of that is that really those types of ideas about the occult nature and about spiritual and animistic ideas is completely alien to the modern scientific mind. In a sense, what you were talking about, the re-enchantment of life or of nature, is if you look at the last 300 years in science, you've had a progressive withdrawing of all spirit, soul, metaphysical, animistic ideas or forces existing in nature. So everything has been reduced to matter and only material processes following natural laws, being governed by natural laws. And so really you've had a withdrawal of all of these metaphysical forces, and so science is sort of, modern scientists are sort of trapped in this cage of their own devising, in the sense that that because they subscribe to a strictly materialistic viewpoint, they can't kind of go beyond what they've found and realize that you know what would fulfill their what they found is exactly what they've banished, is the idea of metaphysical forces. That's what's so interesting, I think, about what you're going to talk about, is that physics really does have to come to metaphysics to complete itself.
Yeah, exactly. And how the metaphysical ideas really have anticipated a series of these modern discoveries in science.
Yeah.
Okay, so good. Then we'll begin. I'll quote from Stephen Hawking, and he says, nearly everybody in the 18th and 19th centuries believed that the universe was essentially unchanging in time. One could equally well believe that it had existed forever, or that it had been created in its present form a finite time ago. Well, Blavatsky was one individual in the 18th century or the 19th century who did not believe that the universe had always existed. In fact, this is part of what she provided as a model of the universe. Now, her account in The Secret Doctrine, she draws from the seven stanzas of the Book of Zen. And I'm not sure how to pronounce this word. It's spelled D-Z-Y-A-N. And the seven stanzas of the Book of Zen depict creation processes according to a mystical viewpoint. And these are said to be of esoteric Buddhist origin. So the stanzas run for about 30 pages, and then Blavatsky then takes 600 pages to explain, elaborate upon what's being said in the stanzas. So I'm going to try to quote some of the stanzas and explain some of the basic concepts. Now, firstly, Blavatsky depicts that before creation, she talks about the seven nights of Brahma, and then the 7 days of Brahma. That creation is a process of creation and then dissolution and back into nothingness. Blavatsky portrays creation emerging out of nothingness, creation ex nihilo in the beginning, and ultimately resolving or dissolving back into the nothingness. The nothingness being the prime source substances. And I'm going to explain what her concept of those prime source substances are. But she says one of the fundamental first fundamental proposition of the Secret Doctrine is the idea of the eternity of the universe in toto as a boundless plane. Periodically, the playground of numberless universes, incessantly manifesting and disappearing, called the manifesting stars and the sparks of eternity. The eternity of the pilgrim is like a wink in the eye of self-existence. The appearance and disappearance of worlds is like a regular tidal ebb of flux and reflux. So the basic pattern of the Secret Doctrine is that in the beginning, or before the beginning, everything is withdrawn into non-being, or the absolute, which I'll describe in a moment. So we begin from a nothingness during the nights of Brahma. And then creation occurs, and the creation is for 7 days of Brahma. Brahma in Hinduism means to expand, and Brahma is regarded as the god of creation. It is like one of the threefold, Brahma, Vishnu, and Shiva. Brahma is the creator, Vishnu the preserver, and Shiva the destroyer. So Brahma is the creator, and Brahma means to expand. So we see in The Secret Doctrine in 1888, Blavatsky was saying that creation firstly began as a differentiation from a point, and that it expands within without from a zero-point source, what I would call a zero-point. She calls them Leia centers, neutral centers. She has different terms to refer to these points. So she sees creation beginning from a point source. And I'd like to just, the beginning of The Secret Doctrine, I'm going to read here. It begins, "An archaic manuscript lies before the writer's eye." This is Blavatsky talking. "On the first page is an immaculate white disc within the dull black ground. On the following page, the same disc, but with a central point. The first illustration represents the cosmos in eternity before the reawakening of still slumbering energy and the emanation of the world. The point in the hitherto immaculate disc denotes the dawn of differentiation. It is the point in the mundane egg, the germ which will become the universe, the all. The one circle is divine unity from which all proceeds, whither all returns." Okay, so this first thought is my head. The first point, then, is that Blavatsky, in 1888, was depicting the emergence of the universe from a point source. And we find the same idea in Kabbalist study, that creation emerges from a point source, an infinitesimally small point, and it expands within without from that point source. Okay, well, as it happens, in the last part of last century, from about the 1960s, they came upon the Big Bang Theory and began to regard, they thought in the beginning, about 15 billion years ago, there was a massive sun, and this exploded with a big bang, and as the matter and energy spewed off, creating an expanding space-time complex. Well, after 1960, physicists wanted to know, well, what happened more and more in the Big Bang, so what led up to this massive super sun that exploded. And they began to trace the universe back closer and closer to its origins. And in about 1984, Steven Weinberg wrote a book called The First 3 Minutes. And in that book, he said, science can now explain the processes that went on within the first 3 minutes of creation. And he explains kind of the elementary particle physics going on in the early universe. Well, by the 1980s, scientists have actually traced the universe back to what they call a singularity. And the singularity is actually assigned a specific value called the Planckian distance of 10 to the minus 33 centimeters. So this is suggesting that our huge, huge universe actually emerged from a point a billionth the diameter of a proton, an inconceivably small point. So this is the concept in modern science. And I accept this in modern science. I believe this concept. I think this is in confirmation of what Blavatsky was saying, that a zero-point source, a zero-point center, things grow within without from a point-source center and expand. Okay, so Blavatsky predicted by over a century the idea of the origin from a singularity source, which is now accepted in modern science. Okay, now, secondly, if we try to understand the root principles of creation. I'd like to elaborate some of Blavatsky's explanations of that. Sometimes, like, God is first one, then three, and then seven. Okay, so Blavatsky, she has one, she explains what she calls the theological trinity. And these are the three aspects of the root principles of creation. And these she calls, firstly, she labels the first element that, spelt with a capital T-H-A-T. Okay, unspeakable. It's the aspect that is just unspeakable. She also calls it be-ness. And she says, and then it is symbolized under two aspects. On the one hand, absolute abstract space, and then the absolute abstract motion. So I want to explain what Blavatsky means by this, her concept of space and the ceaseless breath, which is the primary motion. Now, this is very difficult in a way. Okay, now, imagine for a moment, if you have a piece of paper in front of you, a blank piece of paper, it would be good if you have a blank piece of paper and put a point in it. And then imagine that from that point, draw a spiral going out in that universe, kind of expanding without and kind of going around in circles without, maybe seven circles, and then it begin to withdraw and go back to the point. And then you end up at the point. You begin from a point, the singularity, you expand within, without, and then you eventually withdraw without, within, back to the zero point center. Okay, so there you have one completed involution and evolution of a cosmos. Now move over a little bit on your paper and draw another point. And again, you bring seven circles out from that as a spiral, and then spiral back in to the center. And okay, and you can imagine that you return to the center, again, you go into the root principles underlying the creation of the cosmos. Now, if you look at your piece of paper then, what you have is you have two points with spirals around them. Well, in a way, each of these universes you've drawn that emerged from a point and expanded as a spiral, each of these is a four-dimensional relative space-time complex. Okay. Now, so each of these is a created space-time complex. Like space-time came into existence at the Big Bang. That's how the scientists described it. Like the Big Bang didn't occur at a certain point in time. No, time-space was created with the emergence from the zero-point source at the moment of the Big Bang. That's when time came into being. Before that, it's the eternal. It's the infinite. Now, if we have these, if I look at my page, I can take the page Blavatsky would call the eternal parent space. It is the space that is eternal. So it doesn't come and go like a created universe or a wink of self-existence or a cosmos or a pilgrim like the suns. Instead, the eternal parent space is the background that's always there. So the universes come and go, but the eternal parent space is eternal. It exists throughout all time. It sustains all phenomena that manifest within the created space-time complexes. So in a way, we have two types of space. We have a four-dimensional space-time complex created out of a seventh-dimensional hyperspace, which Blavatsky calls the seven-skinned eternal parent space. So this is one of the most profound teachings in Blavatsky, is this concept of the sevenfoldness of hyperspace. And I'm going to try to find a few quotes here from... She wrote, "Space is neither a limitless void nor..." This gets into some... I skipped that. I'm going to come back to that moment. "Space is called in the esoteric symbolism the seven-skinned eternal mother-father. It is composed in its undifferentiated to its differentiated surface of seven layers." The Kabbalist teachings show this idea. The seven-headed serpent of space called the Great Sea. So for Blavatsky, this eternal parent space is the mother principle. It is like the ultimate ether of space itself, that which gives birth to the different world orders. So the eternal parent space is the mother space. The point of differentiation that emerges from that point, we would associate that with this, the ceaseless eternal breath. Blavatsky explains that before creation happens and you have this eternal parent space, you have a ceaseless eternal breath, which she says nothing is ever still. Everything moves. Everything is in constant motion. What this compares most to is the idea in modern physics. As you go down into the levels of the quantum vacuum, there's ceaseless activity there. It's never still. It's continually vibrating and ceaseless movement and breath in the underlying space. So Blavatsky calls the fundamental movement the eternal ceaseless breath. So you have this, before creation happens, you have this ceaseless breath within this eternal parent space. And it's a conjunction of this male and female aspects which produces the created world. Okay, Blavatsky explains that when that ceaseless breath modifies its motion, it does so on seven invisible points. So just like the eternal parent space is sevenfold, the ceaseless breath, when it functions in a creative way, also has a sevenfoldness related to the sevenfoldness of space. So Blavatsky's theological triunity, if you draw a triangle on your page and write that at the top apex of the triangle, put space on the left and the ceaseless breath on the right. In Kabbalah, we could associate that with Ein. Would associate the ceaseless breath with the Ein Sof hour and space with the Ein Sof. But I don't want to actually introduce that as well at the moment. So this is Blavatsky's concept of the prime source substances. But Blavatsky explains also, she says, the way she describes what exists before creation happens, she says it can only be described in paradoxical terms. She says it is like its infinite light and its infinite darkness, its infinite emptiness, its infinite fullness. It is both the void and the plenum, she says. She says this of the eternal parent space. It is both the void and the plenum. It is the void only to the finite mind, that it appears empty to the mind. But within it, it's really the plenum. The plenum means it contains all possibilities for all creation are latent within the plenum. So Blavatsky is essentially describing the root principles of creation as essentially a void plenum, a seeming void which is really full and the plenum. Now, here again, if we compare this with modern science, in modern scientists, it's accepted what is called vacuum genesis. Scientists believe that the universe, the singularity, emerged out of the quantum vacuum. And if you go in modern quantum physics, what is the nature of the vacuum? You realize that the modern concept of the vacuum is that the vacuum only appears empty, but if you go down to zero-point levels, the vacuum is infinitely abundant and rich in energies and intelligence. So the vacuum is only seemingly void, but also the plenum. Now this also, see, this is the concept that has emerged in modern physics. The idea of the void, the paradoxical void, the plenum. Whether you call it the quantum vacuum or you're describing the roots of creation. Okay, so the first parallel I'm drawing is the idea of creation from a point source. The second is this idea of creation out of a seeming nothingness, which is the plenum. And that's consistent with the scientific idea of the emergence of a singularity out of the void plenum of the quantum vacuum. Okay, now, next point. Well, and also very important here is this idea of differentiating a manifest four-dimensional space-time complex that is different type of space than the underlying space, which is this seven-dimensional hyperspace. See, in the model of consciousness I'm trying to explain, you, in a way, at the heart of being is this emptiness. And you have a monadic essence, like a little superspring particle, that's established in this seven-dimensional hyperspace. And it has certain spin properties. And as it spins away within the quantum vacuum, what that does is it creates particles and forces and energies around it that create a matrix of creation surrounding the central point. So that point, in a way, is brought down through the matrix of creation through into different material dimensions of existence. Okay, so I'm suggesting at the heart of being you have this point source and it's surrounded by these seven shells. So as creation happens, according to Blavatsky, what's happening is the symmetries in higher dimensional space are being broken. This is how physicists today, they say what happened at creation was a hierarchy of broken symmetries that exist in this higher dimensional space. And when these symmetries break, that creates different forces and particles of nature. So this idea of the hierarchy of broken symmetries, this is a basic concept in modern physics and in Blavatsky's ancient metaphysics. We see this also if we take the symbol of the ladder of Jacob in Kabbalah, where we have four trees of life strung together. And the descent of the line of light from the crown through the different dimensions of existence, as it propagates down the ladder of Jacob, what we have is sequential symmetry breaking. And this creates different worlds with different material aspects and forces. Okay, so this idea of sequential symmetry breaking. Now, in the most modern views, the physicists are trying to develop a unified model to explain the four known laws of physics in terms of being variations on one fundamental force. And the physicists believe that the moment of creation, this one force would have reigned supreme. Paul Davies called it the superforce. But then in the first moments of creation, there's symmetry breaking in higher dimensions, and this creates these different particles and forces of nature. Now, in the newest theories in physics, to explain all four laws of physics, known laws of physics, the strong and weak force, the electromagnetic force, and gravity, to explain them all in the consistent theory requires that at every point underlying the four-dimensional space-time continuum, there is a seven-dimensional hypersphere. And if you go to Scientific American, 1985, they began to, there's an article explaining what's called 11-dimensional Kaluza-Klein supergravity theory. So I'm going to try to take this apart a little bit. 11-dimensional. So, and in the newest theories, they say of those 11 dimensions, four are what are called the large dimensions. So those are the dimensions we live in our everyday life. It's the three dimensions of space we perceive around ourselves, and the other dimension of time, which is change within space. So we exist within the four large dimensions. But the scientists are saying at every point underlying the four large dimensions is a seven-dimensional hypersphere. And this was described back in 1985 and has been developed subsequently down into the new superstring theory. In modern science, Green, in his book The Elegant Universe, he described this model of the 11 dimensions, four large dimensions sustained over top of the seven invisible dimensions. They're also called compacted dimensions because they're on such a small level of physical differentiation that they're beyond our perception. They're down at zero-point levels. In Brian Greene's book, The Elegant Universe, he shows the newest model in physics, which is at every point underlying four-dimensional space-time, you have a seven-dimensional Calabi-Yau space. And he has a picture of these on his book, The Elegant Universe. Or you can see pictures of these Calabi-Yau spaces on my website. They look like little monadic essences or points down on this sub-Planckian level. So scientists are actually suggesting that there's this incredibly complex level down, beyond our perception, and that there is, so science essentially is confirming what Blavatsky was saying about the seven-dimensional structure to the underlying hyperspace. Okay, so this is how I say that Blavatsky's model of the seven-skinned eternal parent space anticipates the newest model of seven-dimensional hyperspace. Okay. Now, what's very important, this model of... I remember first reading about this 11-dimensional Kaluza-Klein supergravity theory in Paul Davies' book called Superforce. And he says, we've kind of traced the universe back into the void. And he says it's like everything in creation is kind of like nothing. It all adds up to nothing. It's just like God sculpted the void, Paul Davies said. And in a way, that's essentially what the mystics say, that everything is essentially empty, but it's like God sculpts the void somehow. But anyway, in his book, Davies says, now we've traced it back to the void, it's like we can't go any further than taking the universe back to a point source. But in a way, what we need to see is Blavatsky saying that before creation happened, there was this seven-dimensional hyperspace. And when creation happens, that seven-dimensional nature is manifested within without. So just as hyperspace is seven-dimensional, when creation is created, it is seven-dimensional. And then it is seven times seven-dimensional. Because the principles repeat on different scales. Okay, I'm losing myself a little bit here. So, yeah, Blavatsky says, seven inside, seven outside. Okay, so what Blavatsky is saying, whereas Paul Davies takes us back to the void, he says we can't ask what existed before creation came into being. That's what Paul the Scientist says. Blavatsky is answering that. She said before creation happened, there was a seven-dimensional hyperspace. Differentiation begins from a point within without, and that seven inside informs seven outside. So everything is sevenfold, according to Blavatsky. This is why number seven, she says, is the number of the divine mysteries. That's why a human being has seven chakras, vital energy centers in human anatomy. That's why there are said to be seven levels of human evolution. The sevenfoldness is inherent within all phenomena. All particles and atoms, they all join together to try to complete their shell rings in their organization. And that's like they strive to complete those shell rings. And that's kind of the urge towards evolution. So Blavatsky says, seven inside, seven outside. Now she explains that in the eternal realm, you have what she calls the seven divine suns, and they're latent in non-being. And then when creation happened, the seven divine intelligences, they create the seven luminous suns who embody the seven divine is embodied in the spiritual world. The seven luminous suns, the seven rays, the seven logi. She uses different terms to depict these. In the Bible, I think the term uses Elohim, which refers to the seven creative spirits in Judaism. So seven inside, seven outside. So if we look at the material world, like we take the material world and we study that the material world is composed of elements, of seven rows of elements on the periodic table. Well, Blavatsky's saying there are seven dimensions of creation, and the material world is simply the outermost. So it is one of the seven planes of existence. But in the astral world, the pattern of the sevenfoldness is similarly repeated. So there are seven levels of life and being within the astral world. And then there are seven levels within the mental worlds and the Buddhic worlds and the monic worlds and so on. That each of these levels has seven levels. The Dalai Lama explains that there are seven planes of existence. Each of them is sevenfold, which gives 49 planes of existence. And the 50th is the final one beyond all the 49. So this model of the seven inside, seven outside, this is profoundly important. Okay, I'll pause for a moment. Jim, how are you there, Jim?
I'm there, yeah.
Okay, yeah. I'm still
trying to get over the fact that I can't get all my furniture into my new apartment, and yet we all emerged from a single primordial point 15 years ago, you know. It's when you just look around the natural world around you and think of these ideas, it's just mind-boggling, and it's just quite fascinating, you know, to consider that. But yeah, it's very difficult material in a way to try to, you know, suggest all this because most of us, let's face it, space just is something we just take for granted. Well, we may know from, you know, high school physics that it consists of three dimensions and then there's time, you know, but that's about it. Let's face it, we don't really kind of want to even think about these things. It's
And the new ideas in modern physics, I mean, isn't this idea, like I was explaining today, the seven-dimensional Kolubi-Yau element at every point underlying the four-dimensional space-time complex, eh? I mean, that's remarkable. And that's in modern physics. I mean, that's in Scientific American and Brian Greene's newest book, The Elegant Universe.
Yeah, I guess it's a striking similarity in terms of, you know, the four large dimensions and then the seven compacted dimensions. And I guess, like, that's a hard thing to kind of conceptualize. It's like, well, where are they? you know, these seven dimensions. I mean, what I was going to suggest is that and you sort of haven't really talked about it that much today about zero points, but like these are immeasurable dimensions to us in this world, right? In the sense that like they're beyond measurement.
Yeah, they don't have extension in our world around us.
In space as we know it, they don't exist. Like they're so small that for all intents and purposes, they're invisible.
Yeah, it's like you trace the universe back to a singularity. It kind of disappears from view beyond your level of perception.
Yeah. So maybe you just talk about a little bit about that idea of about how different dimensions can exist and be sort of interpenetrate one another, and the idea of zero points is sort of as gateways or links or
between these levels. Actually, yeah. When I turned it over and invited you in here, I just come up to where I was coming to Point Foundation, but I thought I'd just take a moment to kind of stop and check in a bit. Okay, so I'll pick it up and go into the zero point concept a bit more. So far, I've been talking about the idea of the point source origination, the void plenum of the quantum vacuum, and then the seven dimensionality of hyperspace. I know one thing I wanted to explain here is, according to the model I'm trying to present, the external four-dimensional space-time is really an illusion projected holographically out of this, or surrounding, out of this higher-dimensional realm. And I actually, the world is, the way it works in the way is nothing like what it appears to us to be. It's like the world is created, it's like going to a movie theater, and there's some mechanism behind you that projects the image of the movie up on the screen. And it's like we in life, we take everything happening on the screen to be real. Okay. In the way we in our lives, we think four-dimensional space-time complex is real, but really it's only a projection out of the deeper physics of this higher dimensional processes that I'm trying to explain. So here's a physicist, I just want to quote this. He says, space-time is created by being squeezed out of a point. A space-time structure is created out of a single point. This is a physicist who studied Madame Blavatsky's secret doctrine. He's trying to explain how different Blavatsky's view of what space is and how it compares. Yeah, so the four-dimensional space-time complex is squeezed out of a point. But in a way, that point is always there. It's underlying and sustaining the whole large four-dimensional space-time complex. This is all squeezed out of a point. So the physicist D says a space-time structure is created out of a single point. With this interpretation of space-time, certain paradoxes of non-locality, which require superluminal speeds, are no longer paradoxes. The reason is that everything is always connected because everything is really part of the same point. So in a way, I'm saying there's a deep physics such that at some point, we have this zero-point center within the higher dimensional space of the heart, and everything that we know as life within the four large dimensions is created surrounding this central point. It's very hard to conceive this and what this means. But imagine, just for a moment, the creation of the universe. Like, imagine a complete blackness and everything's withdrawn in non-being. And then the universe emerges from a point and it expands within without like the budding of a lotus, is how Blavatsky describes it. So it opens up and expands within without, And then eventually it gets to a certain point where it begins to contract. Blavatsky says it expands when the breath of the Father is upon it. And she predicted that creation happened with intense heat and motion and activity. But then she says, after a certain period of time, it is the Divine Mother which ingathers the universe to her bosom. So the Father sends out, the Father is the expansive force, but then the Divine Mother at the end of time gathers the universe back into her bosom, into the heart center. So the first is the expanding universe, and then in modern science, scientists think that if there's enough matter in the universe, then matter will begin to close the universe and begin to draw all the matters back into black holes, and these could combine. And scientists imagine our universe, as it was created from a singularity, might eventually all collapse back into a singularity at the end of time. And this is called the Big Crunch. This is the word that was developed in quantum physics. You begin with a Big Bang, and then you end up with a Big Crunch, where everything's crunched back down. You begin with a white hole singularity at the beginning of time, and then when all the universe dissolves back into non-being, you have a black hole singularity. So imagine seeing that. You can draw, I'm over time, beginning from a point, expanding within, without, and eventually withdrawing without, within, back to a point. And draw that on paper, and you can kind of conceive of how really that central point would exist all the time. It's all always there, and everything is created around it. Okay, what was I trying to get to here? Okay, so again, Blavatsky, in modern physics, they wonder, is there enough matter in the universe to close it, make it a closed universe that'll collapse back into black holes and eventually to a singularity? So you see, it is what Blavatsky would call the mother principle. See, it is mother as the roots. The mother space, the eternal parent space, is the Divine Mother. And the roots of matter are within the Divine Mother. So in Blavatsky's account of creation, it is also essentially the forces of gravity that close the universe and bring it back into the prime source substances. Okay, so again, the Blavatsky's model of expanding, contracting universe is very analogous to modern science, how they conceive the universe might disappear into a dreaded black hole singularity at the end of time. Now, one reason all this is very interesting is, remember, in mystical teachings, the microcosm is based on the same principles of creation as embodied in the macrocosm. So this is so profound, is that we work in this same way. I would say we have an indestructible drop within the heart. And when consciousness first connects to the heart in the growing fetus, and the Dalai Lama explains 72,000 channels, veins, and arteries grow out from the heart in the physical anatomy and the subtle anatomy. So everything grows out from a heart center in the developing fetus. And then consciousness circulates all through the body, through all the channels and what are called nadis and so on. But as a person approaches death, what happens is all the vital energies begin to ingather. The hands and the feet get cold, and the subtle energies withdraw from the limbs, and they go into the side channels, and all the energies gather again at the heart. And when all the energies withdraw back into the heart center, that's when the soul leaves the body. So just as the universe begins from a point, expands within, without, and then withdraws without, within, back into the zero point center, I'm saying a similar thing happens to human beings. As we come into the material body and then at death, all these energies gather again and withdraw in through these zero-point centers at the end of life. And it's very interesting how in the modern theory of black holes, the newest theories of black holes try to explain that when any material, energetic, four-dimensional system collapses to a singularity point, because of the laws of entropy, as it collapses to the point, you have an infinite amount of information available at the zero-point level. Because as you have a loss of entropy in the matter and energy, it's compensated by an increase in entropy and information. So what it all suggests is as you go down to zero-point levels, as a system collapses to that level, all the information about everything that ever happened in that system is available at those Planckian levels. And what I'm saying is this is similar to what happens as a person passes through death and you can see your life flash before you. It's like you remember the whole of your life exists all at once, simultaneously, at these zero-point levels, so that as consciousness penetrates down in towards the Planckian source, all the information of your life can flash before your eyes, and you can do a past life review. In a way, it's all simultaneously present. Okay, now I didn't mean to, I wanted to just come back to a few comments on the zero points. I try to give another angle on this. Now, Blavatsky explains it like, she's trying to explain this unusual. She writes at one point, I'll just quote her, a neutral center is, in one aspect, the limiting point of any given set of senses. Imagine two consecutive planes as matter already formed. Each of these corresponds to an appropriate set of perceptive organs. We are forced to admit that between these two planes of matter, an incessant circulation takes place. And if we follow the atoms and molecules of, say, the lower in their transformation upwards, they will come to a point where they pass altogether beyond the range of the faculties we are using on the lower plane. In fact, to us, the matter of the lower plane there vanishes from our perception into nothing, or rather, it passes onto the higher plane. And the state of matter corresponding to such a point of transition must certainly possess special and not readily discoverable properties. Now, this is a very complex and difficult quote, what she's saying. To explain this idea of zero point, if you draw an hourglass on a piece of paper, and you have like a from above, you have a sphere above, and it narrows down to a point, and then below, it opens up again to a sphere. It's like it's called a light cone in physics. What I'm trying to get you to draw is a light cone, or it looks like a, what is that symbol of that time? Jim, what is that where you have those little egg beaters? An egg timer. You know, that's what they are. They look at a little egg timer.
Yeah.
Well, where all the sand from the top kind of seeps through the zero-point center and fills the bottom, and then you flip it over, and it all goes the other way. Well, the center, in a way, this is the concept that you have these two realms, the realm above and the realm below. So for creative purposes, the gods and other invisible powers in the realms above, their intelligences manifest down at the zero-point level and then manifest in the world on the outside. So these zero points the points at which the gods and invisible powers in higher dimensions, their influences emerge from zero points underlying what is created in the material worlds below. So there, these zero points are like these transition points between lower worlds to higher worlds. Any comment, Jim, or am I?
Oh, I just say, I think it's, you know, actually I think this is a very, very important basic idea in esotericism, and one that's really missing in modern thought is this idea of hierarchy and of the essential discontinuity of different levels or dimensions of consciousness. And I think, you know, you could come back to this and expand on this, because I was thinking of both Gurdjieff in Search of the Miraculous describes cosmos in these terms and describes planes of consciousness, and Lama Govinda in Essentials of Tibetan Buddhism explains this with it's essentially the same description, only they're applying it to consciousness within the individual. So it's very interesting, because it's the microcosm of the macrocosm. It's the same principle applying on both levels. And as I say, it's a fundamental like it's a schemata that doesn't exist within modern science. As opposed
it's like modern science only considers the without. They don't think there is a within.
They don't consider
that there are nominal realms underlying and sustaining the phenomenal realm.
Which is exactly what you were getting at with your quote earlier from Paul Davies.
Yeah.
Because he says, we just get to that level, and then there's science can say nothing else beyond that. And within the framework of modern science, that's true, because really it leads to metaphysics.
Yes, it does. You can only trace it beyond there, and it's like the finite, it passes back into the zero, and it just passes into the infinite. It's unspeakable, which is kind of exactly what occultists suggest.
Yeah.
That's why last week I was trying to make the point that how Blavatsky's descriptions here of zero points could have led one to anticipate the development of the uncertainty principle in modern physics. And I want to try to just come back to that for a moment. I've got one other quote from Blavatsky trying to explain this. She says, the chemist goes to the layer or zero point of the plane of matter. Now, what she uses, the layer center, means like a layer center means the point of undifferentiated, before something differentiates out of a layer center. So a layer center is another term Blavatsky uses to describe zero points. In the layer center, everything is balanced and neutralized. So if something withdraws into its layer center, it disappears from view. And when creation happens, it manifests out of a layer center. So anyway, Blavatsky writes, the chemist goes to the layer or zero point of the plane of matter with which he deals, and then stops short. But the full initiate knows that the ring pass not is neither locally nor can it be measured by distance, but that it exists in the absoluteness of infinity. In this infinity, there is neither height, breadth, or thickness, but all is fathomless profundity, reaching down from the physical to the metaphysic, or parametaphysical. Okay. So anyway, what she's saying is the chemist or the physicist, the scientist tries to trace something back, like a particle, you try to trace it back, but you reach a certain ring pass not. Now, ring pass not really is the same idea of the uncertainty principle. You get to a certain level, at a certain level, where you just can't measure something more exactly because it passes into the infinite. Like in the uncertainty principle, the idea is that you cannot know both the position and momentum of a particle simultaneously. That the more closely you try to measure the position of the particle, its energy level becomes infinite. Or if you try to know the exact energy level of a particle, its position passes into the infinite. So it's everywhere. So it's like when you try to narrow any particle to a point, it seems to pass into the infinite. See, that's why Blavatsky's saying, that's what happens when you trace a universe back into a point, and it just passes beyond your perception into this infinite realm within higher dimensions. It passes into higher dimensions, which from the perception of the lower dimensions is unfathomable and infinite. So I'm not sure how that's coming across, but see, this is a paradox of the uncertainty principle. It's like as if we think that there's this infinite being, God, which is the source of everything created in the universe. So if God created, this infinite being created everything in the universe, then if you have one tiny little quanta, and if you could penetrate into the innermost nature of this quanta, it has to dissolve back into that infinite being, out of which it is an expression. So whenever we try to trace anything far enough, it passes beyond our perception into the infinite. So zero points are these levels between dimensions. And in a way, it's through zero point levels that the gods and other invisible powers, these higher dimensional forces, they act through zero point dynamics to create worlds which embody those intelligences. It's very difficult to understand and really what's being suggested here.
Well, we're nearly out of time, but I think that, you know, that this is kind of leading off here. It sets things up nicely that you could return to these ideas about, about the limits of cosmos and the idea of zero points as transition points, because I think, you know, there are a variety of angles from which you can approach this question and deal with it. But it's interesting, I was thinking back to what you began with, that quote from Stephen Hawking to the effect that nearly everyone in the 18th and 19th centuries believed that the universe is essentially unchanging in time. It's, as you say, it's clear Madame Blavatsky didn't, and Stephen Hawking is regarded as the most intelligent person in the world by many people because he's a great scientist, but he clearly doesn't know anything about the esoteric or mystical tradition and what they have to say about the nature of the universe and the self.
Blavatsky was presenting such an unbelievably bizarre concept back in 1888.
Yeah.
People must have thought she was crazy.
We're winding down to the end of the hour. I mean, what a wonderful show. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you, Don. Yeah, thanks. It was really fun today. And thanks, Jim. It really helps having your support there. And you're right there when I need a break or take another angle and such.
Well, it's been my pleasure to participate. Thanks for having me.
And we will pick up again next time. We'll do a part two of The Secret Doctrine, and I'll try to move through some of the remainder of the material I wanted to present. So we'd like to thank BBS Radio, and as I say, they've archived three shows of mine up there now, so please, if you haven't listened to earlier shows, tune in and it's well worth anyone's time to begin to understand the type of teaching we've been presenting here.
Yeah, and thanks to Juliet for that email. That was really good.
Yeah, thank you, Juliet. I'll be looking at your site. It's nice to feel a heart connection to other light workers out there trying to bring about, you know, a greater awakening here. We need to look deeper into these mysteries of the heart and the space. Okay, thank you, BBS Radio. Thank you, James Moffat. In 2 weeks' time, we'll be back for another version of Zero Point Teachings, coming to you from Cars, Ontario.
You have been listening to BBS Radio, a blogandservice.com production and a Service to Others endeavor. Thank you very much for tuning into our radio program, and we wish you much peace and joy on your journey.